And of course, James Barrett with us, author of Our Final Invention. We're going to be back. Final hour to go here. We'll take calls as we talk about the pluses and minuses of artificial intelligence. James, you talk about artificial intelligence and its holy grail. Explain that for us.
And its holy grail. I'm blanking on that, George.
Well, you know, the holy grail is, of course, the end all of everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
In AI, don't you write about that?
Well, I don't think I referred to it as holy grail, so it threw me for a second. But what everyone is trying to get, what a lot of corporations and governments are investing a lot of money in, is called AGI, artificial general intelligence, and that is the holy grail. That is human level intelligence. So yes, a lot of people are really, really interested in that. And for an example of why they're interested in that, you know, and why a huge economic wind propels the development of AI, consider how useful it would be if you had computers that were as smart as humans, and you had 100 computers, PhD level minds, working on the problem of curing cancer, or on the problem of a vaccination for malaria, or HIV. You can see the potential for, and then they're not working like humans. They're not working like human PhDs who work for 8 hours and stop and take coffee breaks and log on to Facebook during the day. But they're computerized, so they go 24/7. They go very fast, and that's what's propelling the development of AGI.
Has AI already surpassed the human mind?
Not in a general sense, no. AI right now, the development does a lot of things really well, better than we do. Search is one. Logical reasoning is another. Accounting, numbers, anything quantifiable. Data mining, you know, mining vast amounts of data for good information. In those realms, AI is a lot smarter than our brains. In a general sense, can it bring all those powers together? No. But you just have to look down the road to see that coming.
All right, to the phones we now go again. Wanda, first-time caller in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hello, Wanda, good morning.
Yeah, well, hi. You practically answered my question. I asked, you know, with all these companies developing this AI, what has the Vatican said about this? Because they have all these technical things that they're doing with what they have in Arizona now. And what do they have to say about it? Do they have anything? Or they're shutting up about it because it sort of kills their whole story.
I'm not aware of any of the Vatican developing artificial intelligence. I think it's mostly being developed by defense agencies and by corporations that see a giant profit.
Yes, that's what motivates them.
Yeah, and that's the huge economic wind that's propelling it. But in terms of religious groups and religions and the Vatican, I haven't seen any evidence of that.
And we have a system now, don't we? And they're working on it. For example, on the grid, where they can shut your power down if they think they have to, for whatever reason.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, George, because that, you know, the problem with AI isn't the technology so much as how we use technology. It's about 50-50, where we need to acknowledge that it's a volatile technology, and then we need to be smarter about how we use it. And the grid is a really important lesson. A few years ago, the NSA developed something called Stuxnet. I'm sure you've heard about Stuxnet.
Stuxnet, explain that.
Stuxnet was a virus that we created, that the NSA created, and it was a Trojan horse that they snuck into nuclear refineries in Iran in order to disable centrifuges that were helping process uranium.
That was the worm in 2010. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It was like something like 4 or 5 years in the making.
Stuxnet.
Stuxnet. So that was created by us, but here's the problem.
And Israel, maybe. Right?
Yes, exactly. Some secret organization in Israel that we really don't have much intelligence about. But so Stuxnet attacked the industrial controlling software, industrial controller software called the SCADA system, S-C-A-D-A, that was built by Siemens to control the nuclear refinery, to control the centrifuges. Well, that same Siemens-built industrial controller is the one we use in most of our energy grid. So we're basically hitting them with a bomb, but giving instructions on how to use the bomb and how to make your own with it. Stuxnet predictably escaped from the refinery plant, was downloaded by thousands of people around the world, and it would just take a smart team of programmers to reverse engineer it and stick it on our energy grid.
Sure.
There's a malware specialist called Kaspersky, a Russian guy who's really smart about malware, and he said that Stuxnet reduced the cost of an attack on our grid from $10 million to $1 million because it basically gave everybody a blueprint.
Well, and the Russian, he once said that this could only be created with a major nationwide support, governmental support.
Yes, it was called Operation Olympic Games. It came out of the White House about 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago. It was created by us. So this is how we use technology. You know, it was extremely short-sighted to attack a SCADA system and to give people the means to attack a SCADA system when the interconnected links that form our energy grid across the country are powered by the same Siemens-built SCADA systems.
And aren't the Chinese doing this to us, too, all the time?
The Chinese, they've made it a major tenet of their economic development to, they'd rather steal plans than do R&D. The internet is extremely porous. It's extremely hard to defend. I've got a whole chapter about that in our final invention. It's extremely porous. It's extremely hard to defend. And right now, viruses and AI are meeting. Stuxnet arguably was a kind of AI. It operated.
That's true.
It operated autonomously. It could duplicate itself.
It was an evil one.
It was our evil one.
So. Yeah.
But it points out the problems with how we deal with it with advanced technology. It was a silly mistake, and I'm sure we'll do it again. And the trouble is, as malware gets smarter, as malware and AI meet up, the repercussions will be very severe. We don't know what the ultimate repercussion of Stuxnet will be. It could be an attack on our energy grid.
Yeah, exactly.
We've given them the tools.
Let's go to Steve in Panama City, Florida. Steven, good morning. Go ahead.
Great to be with you, George.
Thank you.
Let me say thank you on behalf of all the truck drivers. Your support of us is wonderful, and I have spent thousands of hours listening to your shows.
Very well.
Boy, did it make my drives better. Your guest tonight, wonderful, wonderful. Appreciate all the information you're giving us about our government. But on the artificial intelligence, sometimes I like to refer to it as artificial ignorance. You mentioned previously love and passion and those things that drive human beings. And how do you put that into a machine? Steve mentioned about Steve Wozniak about the machine making a cup of coffee. I would put a bigger challenge to it. Put the thing in bed, and when it wakes up in the morning, see if it has a reason to get up.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't need sex. It doesn't need a good pizza. It doesn't need comfort. If it's a really smart machine, if it's a really got artificial intelligence, it's just going to say, and shut itself down.
I'm not going into work today.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't need anything. I understand that, you know, why we have to advance to be competitive in the world in this. But when you really start thinking about artificial intelligence, like you say, it makes us examine ourselves as human beings. And if you pass it a little further along to transhumanism, well, pretty soon we're all just brains in boxes out in the field with a little computer button. Oh, I want to go snow skiing. I'll click the snow ski button. Oh, I want a great lobster dinner. I'll punch the lobster dinner button. So where does it go?
I like that.
You raise a lot of really good points, Steve. There are, right, for the foreseeable future, love and compassion and poetry will be the only source of that. A lot of people think that the closer we get to emulating human brains, we'll finally get down to the resolution of our reproduction, so that of our synthesizing the essence of what it is to be human, that robots will be able to do that too. Why will a robot get up in the morning? Well, at an advanced level, the AI theorists say robots will have self-improving, self-aware robots will have drives, and they'll be a lot like ours. Things like self-protection, resource acquisition, creativity. They won't be benign. It won't be. They won't be inert.
Next up, we go to David in Rochester, New York. Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Ah, good morning, gentlemen. I find your program very interesting. I tuned in when you were talking about, we're trying to emulate human intelligence, and it brought to mind a book that came out in the 1960s about Vietnam by a guy named David Halberstam, The Best and the Brightest. And his point was all these intelligent people got us into this mess. Because of artificial intelligence, I don't know if the human condition will really be improved. Look what we've accomplished over 2,000 years. We've done a lot, but are we any better as human beings? You can make an argument that we really haven't gone too far. We're still fatally flawed, and I think the artificial intelligence would do the same, might do the same thing. And secondly, if you're having a program or a computer, I understand how it can calculate and maybe come up with, all these different, try to find a solution to, you mentioned cure to cancer. I have met a couple of geniuses in my time, and these guys were ineffective. They spent so much time analyzing everything, they just couldn't come to a decision. So I guess maybe what would have to happen would be that, any program or artificial intelligence would have to have some sort of parameter to keep it from going through the move tree or, doing a loop-to-loop thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It'll have to be goal-driven. Any effective advanced artificial intelligence will have to have goals, just like the goal of Watson, IBM's Watson, was to win at Jeopardy. Deep Blue was to win at chess.
Yeah.
They'll have to be goal-oriented. And in fact, there's a lot of reason to believe they won't really be able to exist unless they've got problems to attack, because how do you train it? How does it get better? Unless you've got a domain, an environment for it, and ways for it to learn and master that environment. So advanced AI will be goal-driven. But you raise a really good point, David, with the best and the brightest. I think, you take the smartest people in the room and then put really powerful, really powerful technology in their hands, and half the time they do wonderful things and half the time they do really bad things. So I think this is why we need increased scrutiny on the development of AI. We need transparency.
Next up, we go to Michelle in Phoenix, Arizona. Hello, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How's it going?
Okay.
Going you got well. Me?
Yep. Loud and clear.
You okay?
Are you talking?
We're great.
Yes, I'm talking.
Go ahead.
Are you there?
Nope, got to let you go. You get two times, and that's it. Bob in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, sir. Yes, Mr. Norris, always such a treat to talk with you folks. A great program. I have one I wish I was born about 25 years later than I have been.
Yeah.
I'll be 70 on my next birthday. I'm curious to know when the robots will be truly personal, to come to your home and be a companion and engage in some of the things that men and women engage in.
I think probably sooner than later, don't you think, James?
I think it's going to be the 2020s before we have robots that can really work in the home. There's a robot on the space station right now. It's just from it's a human-like robot just from the waist up. But it's still there's still some fine-tuning to go. I would say 2020 is going to be when we get human assistance robots in the home, and then they'll from there they'll improve. You know, like any consumer product, they'll improve very quickly.
Okay, back we go. We go to Charles in Baltimore, Maryland now. Welcome to the show. Hi, Charles.
How you doing? First of all, I want to make an observation. Then I want to ask a couple of questions real quick. You know, the robot things that you were talking about, like the personal robots, that's a long time in coming. It really is. Now, here's a couple of questions. There was a thing called the Blind Driver Challenge. I think it's still up there on the internet.org. It's under the National Federation of the Blind. There was a blind guy who went on the racetrack,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Daytona Beach a couple of years ago in January. You know, it got national press and everything, where they threw things out on the track, and he was able to dodge them using the modern technology and this and that and the other thing. Of course, being able to do that on the road is totally different. Will that ever really truly come to fruition? And if we have all this computer stuff in our cars, how are we going to have room for luggage and stuff like that to take personal trips?
Okay, well, those are great questions, Charles, great observations. I think the Google self-driving car, Toyota's working on one, Mercedes-Benz is working on one.
Tesla's working on one.
Tesla's, yeah, right. Everybody's working on one. You can see where this is going. I mean, when I talk about a giant economic wind propelling AI, right now it's headed for cars. And I can't guess exactly, but I would say within 5 years we'll see completely autonomous vehicles on the road. And they do things that, you know, as I said earlier in the show, the average level of driving is going to go really high because you won't have distracted drivers. You'll have really, you know, perceptive drivers. The cars will be communicating with each other like a flock of birds, so they won't be bumping into each other all the time. They'll be anticipating accidents. I read about, I think it was Google's car, that if you threw a cigarette butt out from behind a car into the path of Google car a block away, it would be cautious because it would know that a pedestrian might follow that cigarette butt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now that's smart.
Yeah, that's real smart. That's smarter than I am. You know, first of all,
well, we wouldn't even see the cigarette butt from a block away.
Exactly. So I think the blind driver challenge is going to be, you know, I hadn't thought much about that aspect of it, but giving people, you know, freedom and mobility with cars is probably right around the corner.
We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you, James, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you who haven't followed us yet on Facebook and Twitter, do so. Far right-hand corner of coasttocoastam.com. Well, miracles do happen, and our guest on our next Coast to Coast program, Dr. Brian Weiss, joins us. We'll talk about those miracles. And we'll be back in a moment taking your final calls here on Coast to Coast AM. James, is the growth of AI, artificial intelligence, only as good as the human pushing it and the person behind it?
Yes. That's really, you know, one of the central messages of our final invention is that we've got to, as we've been discussing, with so many technologies, you know, the technology gets out there, it's fielded, and then we catch up with stewardship and careful thought about how it should be deployed. Like any technology, artificial intelligence is at its present state it's helpful. It's mostly good. As we get into more advanced AI, then we can really run into problems, and our scrutiny will have to increase.
No doubt. Final calls, Francis in Indio, California. West, hi, Francis.
Hi, George. Oh, my God, I finally got through. I can't believe I tried so hard for so long.
Perfect.
First of all, I have a couple of comments that I wanted to make to your guest. You're talking about one of my favorite subjects. I am absolutely fascinated with robots. But before I make those comments, and I had a question for him, I just wanted to say, George, how much I absolutely adore and love your voice. It is so unique and so fantastic.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
I mean, I'm just absolutely in love with you. In love. But anyhow, And I saw you on TV one time. I was just going out of my mind. But anyhow, I wanted to say that the more higher technology that we become, the more distant and inhuman we become. That's one thing. The other thing is robots can never have one thing, and that's a soul. Okay?
That's true.
And then I wanted to ask your guest, George, if he, I heard or read once that some people are just born with a negative aura about them, and some people are just born with a positive and good luck in their aura. And I just wanted to ask him about that. Does he believe that? Because, I don't know, it seems like all of my life I've had just so much negativism, no matter how I try, no matter what I try. You know, I've always had a lot of negativism.
Does it follow you?
It just seems like everything I try, you know. I'm a professional singer, and I just have a lot of problems, you know, negativisms with that. I mean, if I had a gig to do, I would probably come down with a bad disease or something.
Right before it.
I've done gigs, but it just seems like, you know, I have a lot of negative. But anyhow, I read once or I heard once that there is such a thing as a person having a negative aura.
Well, I agree with that. And I don't know how you tie that into artificial intelligence, James, but there's no question that I've known people who have this black cloud over their heads and they can't seem to pull it away. But she is right about one thing. A robot will not have a soul.
That's a tricky question. I don't think they will. But you know, I think that they'll have, if we get that far, that they'll have a lot of the nuances of human personalities. I think that
it'll be close.
Yeah, and at some point, you know, the Turing test, which is sort of another milestone test for computers, it's not about soul; it's just about emulation. Can a AI represent itself so well in all the domains of thought that you're convinced, as an impartial judge, that it's human, or you can't tell the difference? Is really how the Turing test goes.
Will a robot know the difference between good and bad? Right and wrong?
Not the way we do, not at all. It doesn't have our you know, it doesn't have our sense of empathy. It doesn't have our mammalian heritage that, you know, it never raised children. It never did those things. Those are extremely hard concepts to program into anything. An ethical sense, you know, as you see with Asimov's, you know, laws. Every time you choose one ethical benefit, you might get that to the exclusion of everything else. If you asked a robot to keep you safe, it might tie you down to keep you safe, for example.
Yeah, there might be consequences with those.
There might be unintended consequences. Exactly.
And, you know, you may be hungry, and it may not stop feeding you.
That's right, or it just may plug you into electrodes and stimulate the pleasure centers of your brain until and making you safe and happy. But that won't be really what we have in mind. It turns out that to create a robot that really is looking out for our benefit requires you to create a gigantic database of behaviors to avoid, all those unintended consequences.
Let's go to Rocco in Toronto on the international line. Hi, Rocco.
Hey, good morning. Boy, long-time listener.
Thanks.
First-time caller. I believe that, you know, before we blow ourselves up, there's still some good that come out of this in the immediate future. I'm blind. Do you think they can come up with a guiding robot?
Yeah.
No doubt. What do you think, James?
Well, you know, we were just talking about the self-driving car, and I think that's that would be a great tool for blind people. I think it's going to be a long time before you've got a guiding robot that's as adept as a good guide dog.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Why?
Just because a guide dog. I actually adopted a dog that got kicked out of the school for the seeing eye in Morristown, New Jersey. And the combination of intelligence, of being able to see things and smell things and hear things and interpret danger, is so refined in a good, well-trained dog that it'll be a while before we get that. And only because no one's aiming specifically for that. If they decided that was the number one priority, then we'd have one in the next, you know, in the next few years.
I was at the Burbank Airport Friday, and, you know, sitting out there waiting for my plane, and a blind guy came down. He was all by himself, and he was wearing sunglasses, and he had his cane with him, and he's tapping it to see where he was going. God love him. But this I've never seen before. He was smashing into everybody. And for a moment, I thought it was like a comedy sketch. I mean, because, I mean, I've seen a lot of people who have been blind before, and they're very organized and disciplined with their cane, and they feel around. This guy was like running into chairs and then hitting people with his cane, and then he'd feel them, and then he'd come back out. And for a moment, I thought that this was some kind of act or something that wasn't very funny.
Hmm.
And then some lady got up and helped him and got him to the ticket counter. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I think robots can overcome that.
I think you're right. If there was a targeted program to develop that, I think you're absolutely right. But there are a lot of AI-inspired and enhanced tools for the blind. You know, Ray Kurzweil invented the book reader that reads out loud to blind people. He did it.
That's great.
After meeting Stevie Wonder, they worked on it. They worked on it together. So yeah, there's a lot of great tools that are coming out of AI.
And this is unlike books on tape, I assume, right?
Yes, I assume it had a robot reader. It had basically a reader, and it was optical character recognition. So it read the words, and then it read them out loud.
Let's go to Greg in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I just never see AI surpassing men for a couple of reasons. One would be the ability to have a hunch and kind of go against what the norms are.
Go with the gut.
And the, pardon?
Going with the gut.
Yeah, right. And then the other one would be, say a man works on something for 5 years, 2 years, whatever time. All it takes is one person lighting the spark to send him in another direction, and his complete programming, if you want to think of it that way, has changed. And I don't see that AI would have that ability to jump its track and go with something else and maybe come up with a cure or a invention that would work. Do you understand, kind of?
Yeah, I think that raises very interesting questions. You know, there's a robot developed at Cornell University that observed a pendulum swinging, and without being tutored, came up with some basic laws of physics. It derived laws of physics by observing a pendulum swinging. So I think they will be capable, and at higher levels, they'll be capable of original observation and thought and even experimentation. Will they ever have intuition is a really interesting question. Will they be able to make a decision based on partial information? My guess is maybe, because I think in our brains, intuition is probably a very fast statistical analysis. It probably doesn't show up as statistics, but I think the computer simile to that would be a very fast Bayesian statistical analysis.
Why can't we program AI into empathy, for example, if they saw someone, you know, asking for money at the corner of a street? Would a robot, you know, if it had the ability to have money, would it give it to that person?
We're identifying the things that we like about ourselves. Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
You know, that's a lot of the quest for AI is really revealing different facets of our own personality that we like. I don't, you know, when we think of AI, we have to guard ourselves against thinking of it in a human-like way. That's the thing. You know, if we meet a friendly robot, we have to remember it's a machine. And when we deal with robot technology, we have to keep in mind this does not have our empathy instincts. This does not have our mercy, our kindness. These are machines, and they don't love you or hate you any more than your toaster does.
They won't get angry with us?
They won't get angry. No, I don't, not without being programmed to be angry. Now, if you take a battlefield robot and it's friendly, it'll be a big disappointment to the investors.
Yeah, yeah. It would be.
So,
but that's a matter of programming.
That's correct. Yeah, exactly. So emotions are our purview, and you know, I think it's a big source of trouble when we impute emotions to machines.
What would happen if the two opposing side robots in a war got together and say, "This is crazy. Let's go after the people who made us."
See, now you're taking a human storyline, a plot line, and applying it to the robots.
That's right.
When the robots are going to be, you know, they don't care about stories. They don't want happy endings. They don't appreciate irony. But I think battlefield robots will be extremely difficult, because how do you tell a friend from an enemy?
That's right.
And when the enemies are trying to look exactly like friends and vice versa.
And they will do what they're programmed to do.
They'll do what they're programmed to do to a certain extent. When they become very advanced, then we're not, you know, it comes down to developing a science for understanding machines that are smarter than we are. How will they behave? Will they be, you know, garbage in, garbage out, programming only? Or will they develop drives, as a lot of theorists anticipate, that will make them not benign and harmless, but goal-seeking, efficient machines?
Let's go to Dumas, Texas. Micah's with us. Hi, Micah. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, John. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be on tonight.
Great.
You really just segued into what I was calling about. I have a friend who will remain nameless. He recently retired from the military, still maintains extremely high top secret clearance. He was over at the house. We were, you know, sitting discussing current events, and the season premiere of The Walking Dead came up. So, you know, we got humorously kind of on the zombie apocalypse, you know, scenario [S2] Yeah. [S1] Talk, right? And suddenly he shut down. And he looked at me with this expression that chilled me to the bone. And he told me, he said, you know, you're never going to have to worry about a zombie apocalypse. It's not going to happen. He said, what you do need to worry about, and we as a civilization need to take very seriously, is the possibility of a Skynet-like scenario, you know? And, like, I've never seen him this serious about anything before. It really chilled me to the bone. I just, I wanted to get your ideas on that.
Sure. What's hard to get across, and I try to do this in our final invention, is that the simple idea that just because you saw it in a movie doesn't mean it can't happen. You know, Skynet is a military supercomputer. We're developing really, really advanced supercomputers. They want the military right now is trying to develop a computer that models battle space so that it knows every variable of every intelligent agent acting in that space and can anticipate how the battle will go or how it can be influenced. That battle space supercomputer will have like a you know, they call it God mind. It will look over the whole battlefield. It will look over all the variables, including weather, including resupply, just everything you can possibly imagine, in order to predict the outcome of a battle. Now that thing will have just enormous intelligence. Can we control it? That's the big question.
That is a big question indeed. We're coming out of time here, James. We may take one more call. I'm not sure, but I do want you to get your website out and how people can email you, because I'm getting a lot of messages from people who want to chat with you.
Sure. www.jamesbarrett.com. And the book, Our Final Invention, is available on Amazon. You can see that where it's, you can go to the website and see where it's for sale, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and all kinds of vendors are selling the book. And as of right now, it was formally released 5 hours ago.
You had fun doing this.
I did. I still have fun thinking about it. And I've had fun talking with you about it, George. You've got a great perception about about these issues.
Well, you know, it's exciting to me that there's a future of it, but like you, I share that feeling that things could go awry.
Well, it's hard to imagine, come up with a technology where things haven't gone awry, at least temporarily. Just every, you know, we're looking at Fukushima, Japan right now, dumping hundreds of gallons of radioactive water into the ocean. It's a nuclear, it's a fission reactor. It's, you know, fission has had a very checkered history. We can anticipate with AI, we can try and anticipate some of the danger before it arrives, but it happens so fast with exponentially accelerating technologies that we have to act now. We have to get involved now. We have to learn about it. We have to get politicians involved, unfortunately.
Well, we shall. Hey, thanks. Great interview, James. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.